This is Steve Sherlock with another Franklin Matters radio show, number 625 in the series. This session shares part of the Franklin, Mass. Town Council meeting held on Wednesday, October 6, 2021. The meeting was conducted in a hybrid format. Members of the Town Council, town administration personnel, and other visitors were in the council chambers. Some members of the public participated in person, some via the Zoom conference bridge, all to adhere to the social distancing requirements of this pandemic period. I split the just about 2 hour and 40 minutes elapsed time into three logical segments. First covers the opening, citizens' comments, recognition for the cultural council, and four appointments. Second covers the Franklin Public Schools presentation and the Q&A session that runs approximately 87 minutes. Third covers the legislation for action, council comments, and the meeting close, approximately 46 minutes. The show notes contain links to the meeting agenda, so let's listen to this segment of the Town Council meeting of October 6, 2021.
Presentation tonight is from the Franklin School Department, update to the Town Council, and I know the many members of the school committee are here, but Dr. Hearn is here, and please come forward and welcome.
Thank you. Miriam's going to join me if that's okay.
Absolutely.
Great. Hi, everyone.
How are you doing?
Thanks. Hi.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us, and like to thank Jamie for inviting us to share with you. As you noted, there are several school committee members here in the audience this evening. And we're, I think, really happy to provide an update related to Franklin Public Schools, particularly at this time. It's been a difficult start to the year, but also an optimistic one as we welcome students full and in person. And it's also, I think, nice to be here, you know, when we're making decisions or you're making decisions around budget and those sorts of things, but to be able to be informative and provide a little bit of an update, which is really, I think, more important now than ever. The pandemic has created quite a bit of turmoil, and so we're starting to come to understand some of the impacts that that has had on the school department. And we have kind of three areas that we want to share because we think they're most relevant to you as counselors regarding the update for the schools. So we're going to talk a little bit about enrollment and staffing, particularly what we've been seeing over the past couple of years. We'll talk a little bit about a financial update. A lot of this will harken back to some of the conversations from the budget hearing in May, but we can also talk a little bit about COVID relief funding and how we've been applying that. And school facility planning. Put some things on your radar screen related to school facilities planning. And I'll start just by reminding everybody that we did develop a consensus vision for the Franklin Public Schools in the past 4 years with the portrait of a graduate involving thousands of data points, and that is what we are all working towards, are our Franklin preschool graduates. And it's not just a high school focus, but pre-K to 12. We do have four district improvement goals. The first focused on social emotional well-being of students and staff. The second two are related to curriculum and instruction, and making sure that we're providing an engaging and rigorous curriculum and high quality instruction to meet student needs, and effective two-way communication to support student learning. And part of our district improvement plan takes a look at all four of these goals through a lens of diversity, equity, and inclusion, and I want to be sure to emphasize that. In terms of enrollment and staffing, I have some preliminary information for you. We typically present an October 1 enrollment report to the school committee at the second meeting in October. October 1st is a really important point in time related to school funding from the state, and they will use October 1 numbers to prepare Chapter 70 funding for the following school year. So this is just preliminary information, and I'll cut to the chase and get to the bottom line first and then walk through some of the details. The McKibben report, which were the enrollment projections for 21 and 22, in the aggregate were remarkably accurate and precise. What we are seeing, though, at the elementary level are some fluctuations and some changes. Middle school and high school have been far more predictable. So what we're seeing from 2020 to 2021 to September of 21 in our elementaries is an increase in the number of elementary students that could be predicted in some ways as a result of the pandemic. There were a lot of choices that families made last year because of the pandemic. And we are seeing more students in our elementary school, but there's more variability. Jefferson and Kennedy in particular have more students than McKibben would have projected, and Parmenter has fewer, mostly because of smaller K and 1 enrollment in the past 2 years. But according to the McKibben projection, it's very, very close, within 5 students of the elementary population. And so it's tracking similar to those predictions. At the middle school, we have seen a decrease in enrollment. This was expected. Much of this enrollment driven change is based on birth rates and the census, and that there are far fewer students being born than had previously come through the Franklin Public Schools. And so I know that there's some questions and some wonders about well, what's happening with private school placements, choices, and those are also tracking down. Charter school enrollment for Franklin is tracking down. And again, I think that this is a reflection of decreased birth rate in town. So we are a little lower than the McKibben projection at the middle school level. We did expect to decrease year over year based on fewer students coming through. I put ECDC in the high school, our two ends of the spectrum, so on the same slide just for space. We have more students enrolled at ECDC than we typically do or previously had, especially last year. A lot of families were making different choices for preschool. McKibben had projected 111 consistently based on historic trends and building capacity, but year over year, it's kind of difficult to project. Franklin High School is experiencing a predicted decline as well, and so those smaller numbers are going to be going through Franklin High School in the coming years. And the McKibben projection was spot on, predicting 1682 at the high school for this year. So all told, we are less than we were last year overall because of the expected decrease. We graduated something like 450 students and brought in 280 kindergartners. But we are close to the McKibben projection from 21-22. We track this carefully. There's more information to come. In January, we do a school attending children report and get much more detail about vocational enrollment, charter enrollment, and private school enrollment, among other things. So a lot of questions come to us related to staffing in terms of supporting students, and you'll see over the next couple of slides how we have been kind of tracking with our classroom teacher staffing as we have a smaller numbers of students. Overall, our staff headcount has remained relatively stable in the past several years as roles have evolved to accommodate expanding student needs. So we have added English language learning teachers in order to respond to students whose first language is not English and they need additional instruction there. We have been including more interventionists in our school system. That's particularly important as a result of the pandemic to make sure we have a wider variety of skills among our students, particularly for ELA and math. So we want to make sure that students are challenged appropriately, both if they're exceeding the current standards or if they're lagging behind or have some gaps. And that's particularly noteworthy at this point in time due to the pandemic and remote learning or the shutdown. We've added some school adjustment counselors, and you'll hear a little bit more about how we've applied coronavirus relief funding, but we are really concerned about the mental health supports that students are particularly needing at this time. And so we have added some adjustment counselors and some of the other roles here. I'll also want to point out our digital learning integrationists. Having digital learning integrationists was absolutely critical in terms of making sure that teachers had the tools and skills they needed to meet students' learning needs, particularly over the last few years. But this has really transformed the way we do education. And so we continue to have digital learning integrationists support our staff. The next couple of graphs show, though, we have seen enrollment decreases, and with those enrollment decreases made decisions in terms of consolidating class sections, so going from 4 sections of grade 3 to 3 sections of grade 3, because we have smaller class sizes at the elementary level, and we've seen a little bit of that at the middle school in recent years. So this is elementary class size over the years compared to teaching staff. And this year, our average class size is 20.6. Middle school, similarly, over the past couple of years, seen a decrease in enrollment, and the gray line is the decrease of teachers that we've seen as we moved to split teams a couple of years ago as a mitigation strategy. And district-wide, since FY08, a similar graphic around the number of students we have and our application of teachers across the district. And so with that, I'll turn it over to Miriam, and she'll run through a little bit about school finance.
Great, thank you. So you have heard me talk about Chapter 70 before. Chapter 70, as you know, is the law that determines state aid for each district in the state of Massachusetts. It calculates in 3 basic steps, which are not so basic because nobody really understands Chapter 70. There's about 2 people in the state. In any event, the state determines the foundation budget. That's the amount that it feels is adequate to provide the amount that it feels is necessary to provide an adequate education to the students in Franklin. Then it identifies the district's local contribution, how much the district can afford to pay, and then it backfills the differential with state aid. So the foundation budget is the minimum level necessary, as I said, to provide an adequate education. It's based on 3 key factors: enrollment, wage adjustment factor, and inflation. And as you know, you just heard our enrollment is declining. This year, the Student Opportunity Act kicked in with the first of a 6-year payment, and the rates for the foundation have gone up, but the foundation enrollment, as the foundation budget, as you will see in a few slides, is going down because the enrollment is declining. Step 2 is that local contribution, how much can Franklin afford to pay? That step is based on key factors like property wealth, effort from income, and municipal revenue growth factor. That's also a key factor that we're going to talk about. And then step 3, they'll backfill with state aid. The important concept here is that while the Student Opportunity Act is in play this year, it doesn't necessarily benefit Franklin as much as it might benefit other communities. For Franklin, we are receiving additional circuit breaker reimbursement, and we are receiving reimbursement for transportation. Both of those are projected to be at 75% this year, so that's good. We will have additional charter school reimbursement, and we will also have an increase to our local required district contribution. We currently receive state aid. We are a minimum aid district. We are only going to receive $30 per pupil, as outlined in the Student Opportunity Act, from now until we see some change in our enrollment pattern, i.e. increases. We're right now on a decline for enrollment. And because of that, we're going to get $30 per pupil. We have $11.2 million in excess base aid. We are a minimum aid community. So regardless of what our foundation is, the state is going to require our contribution, our local contribution, to increase before before they give us any additional money. We're only going to get that $30 per pupil, which equates to about $160,000. We are second in the state to Boston, just behind Boston, in terms of excess base aid at $11 million. Other districts, as you can see, are also Weymouth, which is almost $11 million over Bill Ricka, Mansfield. And so that's kind of eye-opening and is another data point that we should be looking at in the whole.
Can I just add one thing to what Miriam had said, which is related to the additional charter reimbursement? So the charter assessment and the charter reimbursement are, you know, certainly things that impact the town of Franklin, but in terms of Franklin Public Schools, that's not, we don't, that doesn't directly impact the Franklin Public Schools budget. So I just wanted to draw that distinction if anybody's kind of wondering kind of directly our involvement. We don't have involvement with the charter oversight governance budget. That's a separate, it's a public entity.
So again, you can see here our enrollment is declining roughly 4% from last year to this year. Our foundation budget, again, while the rates are going up, the foundation budget overall is going down because our enrollment has declined. But our required district contribution takes the bulk of the hit right there at $1.3 million. That's a 3% increase, and it's going to continue to go up. Our net school spending is a combination of our required district contribution and our Chapter 70 aid. So if you were paying attention, on the foundation budget is $59 million, the required district contribution at $42 million, the difference between those two is $17 million. Should be backfilled with state aid, but you'll notice that our Chapter 70 aid is $28 million. The difference between the 28 and the 17, $11 million in excess aid. The state's not going to reduce our aid, they're only going to just give us minimum aid going forward.
I think this slide has, there's so much packed into it that I think is really important. I'm going to hang a sign again on what Miriam said. Enrollment is down 4%, but the foundation budget is only down 0.67%. That's because the Student Opportunity Act said it costs more to provide an adequate education to children now than it did when it was originally set. It costs more to provide that adequate education. Meanwhile, they're also saying, based on the local contribution and the aggregate wealth model, that Franklin needs to pay 3.14% more than it had in the previous year. So there's a lot here in this one chart, and the next couple slides show the trend over time.
So in terms of the required local contribution, you can see where that's gone for the past 12 years. It roughly increases 2 to 3% per year. We're at 71%. Right? The state expects the town to contribute 71% towards the foundation budget. We're going to see in a few minutes where we actually are. So in terms of a percentage of what we contribute towards the school district budget, we're contributing 58%, and then, I'm sorry, we're contributing 42%. We're contributing 58% of our budget, and the state aid is contributing 42, and you can see over time that we are contributing more, where that blue line that's increasing over time, whereas the state aid is the red line that has been decreasing over time. So we often use another data point to compare ourselves to other districts, and that is our per pupil spending. In district, we spend roughly $15,000 per pupil. State average is $16,936. We're 13% below the state average. 75% of districts in Massachusetts spend more than Franklin does. And just restated and seeing that over time, you can see that while our per pupil average has gone up, so has the state's, The gap has narrowed a little bit, but still 10% below. Just a graphical image of that. And then when we talk about net school spending, that's the minimum amount that Franklin needs to spend to comply with the state law. We are spending $7.6 million more than is required. However, that's 11% more than is required. However, there are 78% of districts in Massachusetts that spend more than we do. The average in Massachusetts is about 25%. So most districts are spending 25% more than they're required to spend. Franklin's spending 11% more than it's required to spend. And that's partially because of our budget, and of course partially because of the town's contribution towards education, such as facilities and capital, and certainly CARES money, although that is not some of those items are not part of net school spending. We certainly appreciate the contributions to school.
So that's following sort of the basics around our Chapter 70 and state and local funding. We're going to kind of pivot next to a little bit of kind of the current status of Franklin Public Schools and how we are faring and the impact of the pandemic on funding and its implications. So we're really trying to be very strategic in thinking about how we're applying additional funds. The state was hugely helpful in terms of stabilizing Chapter 70 last year. It was a challenging budget year because the budgets were so late, as you know, but they really, it was huge to have them stabilize Chapter 70 at FY20 numbers. We were really concerned about losing a large number of staff in order to potentially have to meet a 10% reduction in state aid. They stabilized those numbers and we were able to recall staff. So I want to also dispel any misinformation that's out there that there were massive layoffs. We were able to recall staff as a result of the state stabilizing Chapter 70 last year. The additional coronavirus funding that we've received, and there's been a number of different segments of that, we've been reporting about that to the school committee and recently had a survey out, which was hugely helpful to understand what stakeholders in the community are thinking we should do with the ESSER III funding. That was a requirement to seek stakeholder input. And we've really been trying to be strategic to apply this funding towards longstanding challenges in the current educational system. So we talked about digital learning integrationists, we talked about additional counselors. So those are some of the areas of focus that we've been working on. There are other matters as well in food services. I do want to be really, really forthcoming and thankful to Jamie in particular for being such a collaborative partner in pandemic recovery. There have been so many collaborative conversations and a lot of support from the town administrator's office so that we can strategically use our funds and maximize those to support students. And so I just want to be really clear to thank Jamie for that. So we do try to think about the multiple sources that we have in order to meet needs. It includes our state and federal coronavirus relief funds to the schools and the town. We have ESSER funding, which is federal relief funding that will extend through FY24. So we're trying to be strategic in thinking about spending that. We need to meet students' needs now, but also build a plan so that it isn't spent too quickly. And we're providing some ongoing support because this is going to take time. What is something that should be funded through operating or capital? Additional town coronavirus relief funding, state funding earmarks. There are some earmarks out there to support health and mental health. So we want to, again, we're really trying to think strategically and not and make good use of our dollars. DESE has been a partner in this in terms of providing air purifiers, professional development. They're doing a lot of support that is going, I think, largely unseen. And other grants that may come our way. There was a couple of special education grants to support additional special education services as part of the federal relief package. All of this is to say there is a big worry and concern about this one-time relief funding and thinking very strategically and not just short-term but long-term about a potential funding that could be created. So some of the highlights and how we've supported our students. As you know, a big piece was around technology to support remote and hybrid learning. But again, this has completely transformed many things about how we operate and how we instruct. And so that will be continuing. The facility support has been fantastic. So much to be proud of there in terms of being on the front edge of that. Ventilation is so important. Everybody realizes that now, and I think there was great foresight to be thinking forward about the UBGI technology. PPE and other health-related needs from the facilities, like cleaning materials and hand sanitizer, of course, has been part of our needed expenses. Focusing on social emotional well-being and learning, we've added additional counselors and mental health supports for students, and increased our nursing staff, as you might imagine, in order to support the health of students and staff in the building. And then in academics, high quality instructional materials, print and online, and assessments to gauge student skills, and our interventionists. And we recently put forward a proposal to the school committee and have applied for the ESSER III grant, and looking at providing additional mental health supports to help students who are returning to school after clinical or concussions, hospitalizations, physical or mental health reasons, that will support a very critical need that, getting back to one of the other slides about longstanding gaps in education, many other districts have had these programs to support students who are returning from hospitalizations, and we haven't. So we are trying to strategically use those funds where they're going to make a huge difference. We have a plan for a director of social emotional learning and equity to be sure that we're addressing social emotional skills, but also doing so with a lens of diversity, equity, and inclusion in our community. We have additional tutoring, which parents had requested for middle school and high school, and then interventionists. So that's the closing the loop on the ESSER III funding plan. So some major takeaways. Our FY22 budget prioritized class sizes, academics, and SEL interventions. We were able to support the budget with the town allocation, as well as the supplemental state and federal aid to meet pandemic learning needs. Couple summary pieces around what Miriam had talked about in terms of Franklin's funding per pupil, as well as the percentage of local funding going towards the budget. It is expected by the department to increase, and we need to be planning for the long-term learning needs of Franklin Public Schools students. So this is really timely in terms of we're kind of at the point of starting to see some of the initial results of the pandemic, enrollment fluctuations, but we need to be thinking long-term about that. Part of that involves school facilities. So that's kind of the last component here. Just wanted to talk a little bit about some timelines. We have been in the midst of this, very busy with the transition of students from Davis Thayer to Keller, not just students, but the staff and also materials. I will give a shout out to Eric Stark and Jesse Craddock, the principal and assistant principal, who are doing a tremendous job, as well as our staff and our parent groups as well, who are and have been leading the way as part of a steering committee in the spring. In terms of the facilities, so the move happened over the summer. Teachers packed up materials, and those materials were moved during the summer into their new classrooms. There was also some movement and some shifting that happened at Keller, too. So it wasn't just a matter of impact to Davis there, but there was also some changes that needed to be attended to at Keller. This fall, the staff at Keller are in their new classrooms. There have been a few times where they have gone back to Davis there to retrieve some materials that they wish they had brought with them. So they have been able to do that, which is great. We have also identified useful materials, and they have gone to other schools in the district. Other principals have had a chance to weigh in and say, we need this, we need this. And it's been really helpful in our libraries in particular with some makerspace materials. We intend to declare any materials at Davis they are surplus. That is a process that goes to the school committee, so there's materials in there that may no longer be needed. They could be donated, they could be sold. That is typically what we do with our surplus. We've kind of put out there a number of times the idea that at the end of the year that the school committee, it's their vote, but on my recommendation, would declare the building a surplus to return to the town. So that's kind of the time frame that we've been talking about and operating under. This winter, we'll need to begin the master facilities planning process. As you know, that was a recommendation that came from the facilities analysis report. And we'll start the school committee discussion. No plan will be put together by the spring of 22, but there will be a discussion happening to work towards that plan for the master facilities of all the schools. I do want to also note, I think that the pandemic has had some implications on facilities planning, and it's going to, I think, necessitate some additional time with a master facilities plan. The pre-pandemic demographic report and the facilities analysis report need careful examination. Both of those were done pre-pandemic, and I've already sort of highlighted how some of our enrollment trends in the aggregate are what would have been projected, but at the elementary level in particular, there's more fluctuation, and any master facilities plan is going to need to account for the what I would say is unexpected fluctuation that happened at the elementary level, which I think has to do with the fourth bullet there, which is single family homes. This was a busy real estate market this spring, and the demographic report had an assumption of 275 single family homes turning over each year. We actually had 260 as of September 30th. So that is part of why there's that fluctuation at the elementary level. As a result of the pandemic, we're using our school spaces differently, and the facilities analysis report, all of those standards were based on a much different conception about how much distance we have from each other, and we're using spaces differently. We have additional small group spaces for targeted instruction and additional needs for counseling spaces. And so our space needs have changed as a result of the pandemic. And I think that we're beginning to realize the results, but you know, the question is kind of long term. And I do wonder about the future enrollment trends based on the future real estate market. I think nobody knows what's going to happen. Nobody knows what's going to happen with that market, but those single family homes turning over is one of the biggest drivers of the demographic report. So so that is an unknown. So we need to let, I think, some things settle. We need to study it, we need to plan, but I think there are some things still, some variables out there still to be determined. And with that, we'd be happy to take any comments or questions.
Thank you, Sarah. Miriam, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Enlightening, for sure. Okay, questions or comments from the council? Councilor Chandler.
Through you, Mr. Chairman. First, I'd like to thank the school committee for coming tonight, too. And there's a few candidates in the audience. We appreciate that, too. because I think it really shows that everyone's really willing to work together, especially at this on the budgets, which are, is always the big thing. Hi, Sarah. Hi, Miriam.
Hi.
Okay, I was really psyched to see that you had that expanding role in education slide up there, because speaking of the budget, you know, not everyone's in a bubble where they're all gung-ho to give the schools all the money. And I think that pie chart that you have there, let me just say a few things. You know, there's interventionists, what else do we have here? Curriculum specialists. And you said that this was critical, digital learning and integrinous. Thank you. And I just think that you guys are on budget time. This goes for all the candidates and people on the board. You just need to explain this when it comes to that, because people are going to forget what all this means. And it does, some of it might look like, I don't want to say a waste, but it might look like not needed, or they might not understand. And I just think that it just needs to be explained so much. Maybe that's something everybody can work on. So, and you threw out a couple stats that, one, back in 2010, we were, like you said, the local contribution was only 50%, and this next budget coming up is gonna be 71%. So that things like that hurt. They hurt. And Jamie, you awake for this one? Wait a second. There's one other stat that's the best and the scariest stat that I've heard in the whole 2 years I've been here. And that's the one that Franklin is second to Boston in state aid. So if that ever goes south, we might as well all just shut the lights, right? So that's all, but everyone's doing a great job. Thank you everybody for wanting to work together on this, and it'll be a good budget season. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Councilor Chandler. Councilor Jones.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, thank you for coming tonight. It's good to see you, Dr. Aaron, and always good to see Mary as well. I think everyone can agree that being an educator in normal circumstances has always been a difficult thing to do. Myself being an educator, COVID just multiplied the difficulty that went with that, on top of additional expenses that are associated with that. And we want to continue to provide an excellent level of service to our kids. It's sad to see that we are as far behind the state when it comes to providing funding. I hope that can be remedied. And it's going to take a lot of discussion between now and budget season to come up with ideas on how to address those funding issues. But before I do that, last time we met, you guys were kind enough to present us with a list of unfunded mandates. And I just wanted to read something real quick for both the public and the council. And this is, I believe, Mary, I don't know if Mary knew about this or who, but this is in regards to unfunded or underfunded state and federal education mandates. And it states that school districts continue to bear the cost of implementation and compliance with various statutes, regulations, initiatives, grants, directives, many of which distract from the primary function of educating children in schools, classrooms. These often controversial unfunded mandates become onerous during challenged economic times when services to children fall victim to these mandates for compliance with order, task rules, directives, and state federal governments. That's a very poignant statement in regards to these are potential ways that we could save money if these weren't things we were currently funding at our own expense. Is that a fair statement?
Can you say the last part again?
These could be considerable savings if these were things we weren't necessarily funding ourselves.
I think there are, with the unfunded mandates, I think there are some things that if we didn't have those mandates on us, we'd have much more room and flexibility to be more local.
Right.
I think that was written by MASC.
Okay.
They put together a report on it.
Okay. I just have a couple questions that are listed in this. I'm not sure if you guys will be able to answer or not. Both of these are in regards to staffing and educator evaluation. Myself, having been through that program, it's a rather archaic program. Under staffing, it's written that professional development with the enactment of education reform, all teachers and professional staff must be recertified every 5 years. The district must provide professional development required for recertifications at no cost to the individual employees. High qualified staff, the requirement is a mandate to ensure that employment and reporting of high qualified staff and members investment of time and money into all school levels. In many cases, there are insufficient guidance for districts to enable administrators to assist teachers and professional staff to meet these requirements. For example, appropriate licensure and completion of designated number of courses is required for teaching assignments for which licensure may not exist. Under educator evaluation, and I'll just kind of skip to the best part, this is a highly prescriptive and detailed system requiring considerable amount of time to conceive, implement, and utilize. These are mandate hours of training for the evaluees, most extensive training required evaluators. It is estimated that at least 10 hours a week of principal's time must be devoted to the implementing of a new evaluation system, in addition to language that must be collectively bargained. What I'm getting at is these are ridiculous amounts of hours that go into both staffing and teachers' time that could be better spent teaching our kids. I don't know if the numbers that are listed here are in direct connection to what I just wrote or what I just read, but according to the number that's listed here, staffing professional development expenses for recertification, which are expenses that we incur that the state requires us to do, is $1.5 million. Is that still accurate? Because is that coming out of our expense, even though that's a state-funded mandate?
I don't think that number is kind of an annual number. When we tried, and it was very hard, to quantify this, but some of that goes back to when the educator evaluation system was first implemented. Yep. Back in 2012 or something like that, there was more startup costs. That's when the contract language gets negotiated and training happens, so it was more expensive then. That wouldn't be an annual number that we could hang a sign on. So it was our best effort to sort of quantify over time what these items may have cost to Franklin as well as other districts who have to implement the same things.
So if you could it would obviously be a guesstimate. What would an annual expense be towards these professional development expenses?
We have, I don't think we have it with us tonight, but in the budget materials, we do, through the reporting to the Department of Education, have to break down our professional development amount. But I don't know off the top of my head.
Okay. Either way, it's probably a considerable amount of money per annual budget, right, that goes towards this.
Sure. So I have mixed. So we're mandated to do professional development to help teachers with licensure,
right.
But I wouldn't want to lose sight of the idea that we would still want to provide professional development to our staff. Education is increasingly complex. We need more time for professional development, more training for our staff. So I don't want to lose sight of that as well.
Right.
I think what's hard is the mandated training that we have to do, rather than focusing on some things that would support our local goals. And so we're just constantly squeezed and pinched.
No, that's logical. One thing, the only last question I have is in regards to, I wasn't quite clear on what this was here. Unexpected education funds. It states that Massachusetts local school districts are required, unlike as in many other states, to return at the termination of each fiscal year unexpended, unencumbered funds to the municipality's general fund. This requirement is counter to stimulating incentives for school districts to find creative ways to generate savings throughout the fiscal year. Municipalities often conclude that fund which are returned at the end of the school year. It is misinterpreted as evidence that the school district do not really need said funds. School districts are not permitted to establish a rainy day fund. What does that really mean? I don't quite understand. Is there always a percentage of funds that aren't used?
Yeah, so what that means is anything that's allocated to the school department that the school department doesn't spend returns to the town general fund. It falls to free cash, and
right.
Then it gets certified in November. Generally, the school department spends probably 99.8% of its budget. You know?
100%. Yep, we're expecting to, yeah.
I hope you would.
So there is very little return to the town.
Okay. The only reason I bring up even just a few of these things that are listed in this is because there are from my understanding, almost close to $5 million worth of estimated unfunded mandates that the school currently incurs. And this is a level of funding that we could address at a state level, and federal level, that we should really be addressing, because like we have to deal with stormwater from the EPA, where they're trying to force us to do an unfunded mandate to address stormwater issues, that's not something we want to do at the taxpayers' expense, local taxpayers' expense. So my point is to my council and the audience is that we need to start focusing back at the state and the feds to push back a little bit on some of these things that both take away our funding, your time, and our kids' learning. And that's my only real statement. I know Mr. Cowan, Mr. Chairman, is looking at me like, can we end this already? But before I finish up, I just want to thank everybody for all the hard work they put into making this past year happen. I can't understate how much work and effort every single teacher has put into educating our students, regardless of how much that COVID has interrupted our time. So I just want to thank you and thank you for your time tonight.
Thank you, Councilor Jones. Councilor Hamlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, through the chair. Thank you, Sarah and Miriam, for being here tonight and bringing us this information. It's great to talk about it, to start the process thinking about what's going to happen in the next fiscal year. And I'd also like to thank all the school committee members for being here tonight and on Zoom. I think you answered almost all of my questions, but I'm just going to ask them quickly to make sure I got them right, okay? So the rise in enrollment in other elementary schools, excluding Davis Thayer, is not because Davis Thayer is gone, it's because there are new children moving into Franklin.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And the McKibben report was done before COVID.
Yes.
Okay. You mentioned something about the numbers that we talk about in the budget of students might not be the number that the state uses in October. Do we normally get more students come into the town after October?
We do. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I don't have a number, but we do end up with students moving in after October 1.
And I'm sure most parents want to move before school starts.
Yeah.
Most of the time.
But I'm sure it doesn't always work that way.
It doesn't always work that way.
And so you have to figure a way to fit everybody together.
Yes.
Okay. That makes it a little more complicated. So the required district contribution is up 3.14%. I'm going to go back to the foundation budget table here. But Franklin already spends more than 11% above the required district contribution.
Yes, right.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. We always talk when the budget rolls around, we always talk about level services and the increase of the budget then to be able to actually have the level services that we need for the students. Is there any idea yet about what that increase is going to be? No?
It's early, I think,
yeah,
to know.
Early.
Yeah, I think it's early to know. I mean, I think we had some future forecasts and projections in previous years, but we're in a bit of a different environment now in the past 2 years, from a budgeting standpoint. So we'll be starting to work on that within the next couple of months to look forward to next year.
All right. Well thank you, and thank you for all your hard work.
Thanks, Bill.
Thank you, Councilor Hamlin. Councilor Pellegrini?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I will reiterate what they have said is thank you very much for coming tonight, giving us all of this information. I wish that we had decided before they started to speak that we could ask questions as it was going on. Because right now, some of my questions, I don't even remember what page it was on to look at, but we shall see. You're saying 14.698 is what we pay per pupil. Is that correct?
$14,000.
Yes, yeah, $14,608 is our per pupil cost.
Does this include any of the additional money that we get from the state and federal government or wherever that they give us money? Is it added on to our per pupil expenditure?
Our per pupil expenditure is all of the expenses, state and local, that divided by our enrollment in essence. That's the simplistic way that it's calculated.
Okay, so any of that other money that is coming in?
The CARES money, no, none of that. It's impacting our per pupil spending.
Okay. We spend less per pupil than many communities, and I saw the list here and all. I'm curious, how are the communities doing that get more money for their pupils compared to Franklin? Because I think that we do very, very well. Our teachers are experts in their field, and they carry themselves very well. How do they compare? How do the tests compare in Franklin to those towns that are getting more money? Is there a way to calculate?
Yeah, I don't have the answer tonight. That's something that we could look at and put together. And I think we'd want to sort of think a little bit about what those comparables are. But so I'm sorry, I don't have an answer for you tonight.
That's okay.
But it's a good question.
That's okay. I also wanted to know, with this COVID year, the students all learning on the computer, have we found that many students fell behind? I'm hearing it from some people that their own kids have fallen behind. If the answer is yes, that you do see that, how are we taking care of that?
Great question. We are seeing some, I don't want to say falling behind because I think that I understand that it's
what choice of words?
No. Everybody's talking about learning loss. That's another thing that we're hearing in education. And I just, the kids have been through so much, and they're so wonderful. And I want to acknowledge their strengths and not leave them feeling like there's anything wrong. It's been a very difficult year, and so we wouldn't expect them to be necessarily where they otherwise would be under typical circumstances. But we are seeing that compared to kind of grade level expectations, that fewer students are meeting expectations or exceeding expectations than they had. This is consistent across the state. It's consistent across the nation. It's happening more acutely in math than in ELA. And part of how we are remedying it is through that strategic application of our coronavirus relief funding. The curriculum specialists are playing a huge role, as well as the teachers and the interventionists, to provide a system of supports for students who need extra attention in certain skills so that they can meet grade level expectations. So if they're missing a skill, it gets identified. We have some new assessments that we're using to better able to identify what those skills are, and then give them the instruction that they need in that small group environment. And we have those assessments MCAS only happens once per year, but the growth assessments that we're using have a monitoring component, so we can apply them again mid-year and end of the year to kind of check in on how the students are doing. But teachers are also using assessments in the classroom to check on their learning throughout the year.
Do you think that they have been looking into doing away with the MCAS because of COVID?
I do, absolutely. So one of the things that the pandemic pointed out are a lot of inequities in the educational system, and one of those areas is in MCAS, and other things related to the MCAS, including how it may narrow the curriculum as well. And that it doesn't necessarily reflect higher level skills that students are doing and learning through things like project-based learning. So I do think that part of the pandemic had an impact on people advocating for getting rid of MCAS or thinking differently about assessment at the state level.
Are any students, just a couple,
sure,
any students receiving remote learning now rather than, you know, in person?
We are not permitted to do remote-only learning from the Department of Education. It's not an option or a learning model that we can offer. There are a small number of students who may have unenrolled from Franklin and enrolled in one of the public online schools. There are two in Massachusetts. Or they may have chosen to homeschool and done an online program out of state. So there's a small number. It's not huge.
I think that's it. Just to say thank you very much, and to thank you to all of the teachers. I mean, such a difficult thing to do this past year, and they came to the head of the table. They did very, very well. And that's through you, both of you. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Councilor Pellegrini. Councilor DeLocco.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Actually, Councilor Pellegrini took all my questions. My question was, how are all the students doing, first of all? How, you know, overall? I noticed through the Safe Coalition we found a little bit of a drug addiction pop up, especially in the high school, middle school area. I don't know if you have noticed any of that, but I know we have noticed that.
And yeah.
Through some of the other communities in some of Franklin. So that's something to watch out for, obviously.
Can I chime in on that?
Sure,
I want to be sure too to give the Safe Coalition and Jen Knight a huge shout out. She had done some really excellent professional development with our counseling staff at the beginning of the year, talking exactly about that. What are some of the trends that have emerged, and particularly around the middle school? So it's definitely on our radar screen and something that our counselors are attuned to.
Awesome. Yeah, outside of that, Councilor Jones had some of my questions, but everything else is good. But I mean, I want to thank you guys, because all your education, I'm pretty sure there wasn't a class in college that said how to handle a pandemic. You know what I mean? So, you did a great job. And a shout out to the school committee. You guys worked awful hard. I mean, I would have hated to be on that committee. But you guys did a great job. I'll be honest. I'm going to be honest with you. But you guys all did really work really hard, and I appreciate that.
I'm trying to get more people to run.
I wanted to after this year, but that's okay. But thank you, guys. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Councilor DeLocco. Councilor Frangello.
Yeah, thank you. Through you, Chair. I'll echo all the thank yous that have been made. A few questions. One, and this was sort of, I think, what Councilor Pellegrini was alluding to, but how do we measure success, right? Like, this is all inputs. How do we measure outcomes?
So I think there's a variety of ways where we measure outcomes. A couple of things come to mind. Some of it, we're in an environment where we measure it through test scores. But I think that test scores are very flat and don't necessarily reflect other outcomes. We have some remarkable things going on at the high school in particular, where students are doing and really succeeding and excelling in some national challenges. So DECA being the prime example of how well our students are doing with their global challenge win a couple of years ago, which actually involved masks pre-pandemic, and it was a mask that could connect inside a hoodie. It was very clever, and I'm surprised it hasn't taken off. So we have, you know, certainly student projects, the mock trial team. That's another way of measuring success. I think their post-secondary pursuits is a way to measure success for our high school students. Looking at the younger students, measuring success includes the civics projects. The eighth grade civics projects, I think, are becoming a standout in terms of what students are doing to advocate for something that they're passionate about and is meaningful to them. I would love to see more project-based learning. I think that that is a way for students to really put their skills together. But those are not necessarily the things that sort of hit the headlines. Always, test scores seem to kind of drive and dominate there. Although test scores carry some currency, so we do pay attention to AP scores, for example. In some recent years, we had an achievement around the number of students taking APs and also how they performed. So we were on kind of a honor list, so to speak, of in that regard. I think we also measure success by what we're picking up from in a social and emotional realm, that students are happy, that they have social skills in terms of communicating with each other and relationship development, that they have nutritious food, and that they're like more holistic needs are met as well, so it's not just an academic component or academic achievement. So thank you for the question. It's one kind of regret that I have about the presentation is that combined with like what are you getting for your investment, we don't have the commensurate sort of achievement factors there. Some of it was, I think, a time piece in terms of the presentations were already, I think, 32 slides. But it's really, really important, and I thank you for asking that.
Yeah, thank you. It's a rough measure, and there are a lot of flaws. The U.S. News ranking is the one that is probably the first one that pops up when you look at how and. First flaw, as it is, you know, the fact that we're in the bottom 75% of schools pay more than us per pupil, and yet we're in the top 100 of schools. That seems like a decent, at a long distance measure of how much bang for our buck we get, or how well we do for a little.
Can I add to that?
Please.
The U.S. News and World Report, I think some of the metrics there, one of the biggest ones that a lot of those rankings talk about are the student to teacher ratio. And we've had challenges of late in terms of staffing our high school, and the student to teacher ratio isn't favorable. It does cost us in the rankings. I just put that out there as kind of one of the challenges that we faced. I think the decreased enrollment at the high school will help with that. But I think it's kind of to your point around the per pupil cost kind of reflect one of the areas where it gets reflected.
Yeah, well, that was going to be my follow-up is are there other ways, like what do they look at?
Yeah.
And do we care? And if we do, then, what are some gaps that,
I think we do care. One is that off the top of my head, the teacher to student ratio, but then there's also test scores that they look at, the AP scores and the MCAS scores for something like the Boston Magazine. And those scores are going to be dependent upon the teacher to student ratio. The smaller the classes and the more attention the teacher can give individual students, that should lead to some better success.
That's good. Thank you. I have one more.
Sure.
I think what I was an outsider looking in on this conversation, what I think I'd be missing from this is sort of like how did we end up paying so little? Like, what is the actual process of essentially the funding process? And do you come to us every year asking for more money and we don't give it? Or on the reverse side, let's say we as a council do want to, and listen to people and decide we do want to spend more in our education. What is the process for that? So you get, I guess, answer either way.
Yeah. So I may have to answer it over to Jamie a little bit, because it's not just a school department answer. It's not something that sort of solely resides here. And there's a kind of process with the town. When you say how did we get here, you mean like in previous years? How did this sort of build up over time?
Sure. It sounds as though like one of the conclusions is that we're not investing as much as we could in our education. When is that decision being made? Where?
I think it's built up over time in two regards. One is One is in relation to the factors that go into the local contribution formula, which is the median income in the town, as well as property wealth. And so those two numbers have driven up the formula around expected local contribution. And I say that sort of, and I said this at the budget hearing, you know, with all respect, recognizing that there's economic hardship in town too, and folks on fixed income. So, but sort of in the aggregate and in the numbers, the property wealth has increased, as has median income in the town, over a long stretch of time. So this has happened over a long period of time. Over that long period of time, we've also had the enrollment decrease as well. That was, I think, kind of an echo after the big growth spurt 20 years ago or so. And so so those two factors combined kind of brought us to this point. I don't know if Miriam or Jamie would have anything to add to that.
Jamie?
Through Mr. Chairman, Councilor Vigilio raises an excellent question. I think the superintendent nailed it, kind of like we discussed, I think, back at the budget hearings regarding, it's literally called the aggregate wealth model. And it was enacted in 2006, and it balances out a community's income, wealth, and land value. And, you know, we talk about affordable housing soon. I don't think it's shy on anybody in the community that over the last decade, not only has the income and discretionary purchasing power in the community increased significantly, but the land values relative to back when the first major housing boom in this town occurred in the 80s and 90s and early 2000s. Even though those homes were being built, in huge droves, the land values were still pretty low. Many folks probably in this room or folks listening at home on Franklin TV or live streaming it benefited from that and bought a home for $220,000 or $185,000, what we can now call the good old days. Where now you're looking at a median home value well over $500,000 in Franklin. And I don't think, I certainly can't predict the future. I don't think that that's going to plummet anytime soon. And so your ability to pay as a community, while being extraordinarily sensitive to the fact that there are many folks on fixed incomes, as the superintendent pointed out, the reality is that's why you see on that map that we're second to Boston with that gap of 7 million that Councilor Chandler pointed out. And really, we're first. Boston is an exception to virtually every rule due to the incredibly unique dynamics of a city of that size. That's gonna be that dynamic in any state in New England or across the country. And I think that really does show that in the 80s and 90s, the state was getting way more than its fair share in state aid. Mm-hmm. Okay, and so what we're coming to is a point, and I think the superintendent's graphs and the discussions that we had are getting to that kind of point. And I think we expect over the next 10 years that there's going to be some equilibrium that's going to kick out, some plateau that's going to hit where the chart that Miriam spoke to, that those charts are going to continue to extend off, and this dynamic and the closure of that gap of that 7 million number is going to happen. The question for the community is how fast do you want it to happen and how much do you want to pay for it? And those are serious policy questions, I think, that are going to be certainly dynamics to move forward. Why? To the second point about the local question, if folks read the town charter, the town administrator presents the annual budget to the town council, the finance committee, and other entities as part of the process. So what do? Generally speaking, around about a month or two from now, we'll start the capital process, and then as that starts to take shape, all departments throughout the town will be obligated to give the finance director and the town administrator, probably around New Year's Eve, usually every year, at the end of the calendar year, a proposed FY23 budget. And then in January, February, March is typically when our staff meet with every single department to find out where those levers are. Are those cost containments there? Are there grants that can pay for other things? And when we go through line item by line item every single year and we evaluate, do we need that still? And everything down to every, you know, $100, every buck, every dollar, really. And, you know, sometimes some things aren't needed again next year, and we take that off the budget. Sometimes costs go down, like LED streetlight accounts. We can try to reallocate monies other places. And when we look out at a five-year fiscal forecast, it's kind of really a pipe dream, because it really is year to year in terms of those dynamics of what other areas we end up reducing budgets or save money, or grants pay for things, or federal money comes in or state money comes in. And then ultimately we go through the Finance Committee extensive process, usually in April, and then obviously the budget hearings come before the council in May. So, you know, I'd be remiss if I didn't say that every department certainly comes to us each year with a big wish list. Just to iron one out that many of you heard, every year the former fire chief would come in and ask for 60 new firefighters. Mm-hmm. He knew it was not possible. It was never going to be able to be funded, and many of you are smiling and laughing. Mm-hmm. And what we've tried to do is eliminate the jokes, right? Like, it's just not going to happen. There's literally no money. Because when we do our revenue sheets, and we look at the 2.5% growth, we look at new growth, we look at license fees, we do our analyses, we realize there's only now new spending, there's only a pie of money that can go out. And so we can look at that and say, that's just not feasible. And so there's a pretty hefty dialogue between myself and every department, including the schools, and Sarah pointed out earlier, where we try to understand what are those critical needs. We know it's not going to be able to be the whole entire amount. But we try to work really hard to achieve in a slow and steady process to try to increase funding in each of those departments, or at least the big ones for sure, each year, where they can continue on with the objectives they're pointing out here. So, you know, I would really encourage a lot of the folks that are listening and want to know about all this minutia to really take a look at the town's budget narrative, our budget documents. There's hundreds and hundreds of pages that's keyword search. You know, go through, familiarize yourselves with it, and then participate in those meetings come winter and spring, you know, to lend their voice into these issues, so that certainly I, as well as the rest of the staff and the superintendent and the elected officials, have a better idea of what those priorities are, you know, in the community, and whether or not they need more money. So I know that was probably a long-winded answer to get to your question, Councilor Fujio, but I hope it was a little bit helpful.
Councilor Franchillo?
Yes. Thank you.
You all set?
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you, Councilor Frangillo. Councilor Bizanti.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair. To Senator Miriam, how are you? Thank you for coming. It was a wonderful presentation.
Thank you.
My concerns are the narrative around the Chapter 70's money. And I just think I'm looking for a solution, and I don't know if there's a silver bullet out there to help, but I fear that when we bring up the Chapter 70's money, and I really feel that our representatives at the state level are really doing the best they can for our schools. However, with the declining enrollments, I think it's a tough argument for them on their end too. So I really feel that narrative might have to be pushed toward or to include the residents of Franklin or the public. I'm all for helping the schools out even more. I'm vested in the schools. I have two grandchildren in the system. You know them. I'm raising two grandchildren. My wife's a teacher at Keller. And I have a front row seat on what a great job you guys do and how well you treat your staffs and the teachers. And I just think we need to find more ways to get what you need. I mean, I've been sitting on this council on and off for 8 years, and I feel your pain. So I'm hoping that we can find a solution going forward and address not just the Chapter 70's money, but perhaps make some hard decisions about what we can do to help the schools more. And probably that's another narrative, more rhetoric going forward for this council or another council, but I think the schools deserve it. I think we need to be the best we can be in the education system. This town benefited greatly from the education system in this town. And part of the reason, part of its success, and maybe we are a little bit of victims of our own success, but most of the success of this town was the education system. Granted, 2495 exits and the two train stops, that helped too. But I mean, the education system, people go out of their way to come to this town for these schools. So I want to keep the discussion going, and I think some of that discussion is going to have to be moved to like either a ballot issue or some definite hard decisions to go forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Councilor Bisanti. Okay, I guess I'm the only one left.
Can I ask just one more question?
No. Of course.
On the TV, the news, I've been seeing that they're having problems with getting food delivered for the cafeterias and that. Please don't tell me it's happening here in Franklin. It is.
Absolutely, yeah. It's happening here.
Okay. I had
a chicken sandwich the other day, and we didn't have lettuce. So lettuce is one of the supply chain concerns or issues that we were having. And I don't know the other details. I just happened to go to the cafeteria that day, but.
Yeah, so some of the menu items that you might see that are listed online might be swapped out on any given day. We're trying right now to order food a month in advance so that we have food to be able to support the menu items that we're anticipating. But trucks are coming in at times that we don't even know sometimes, like when we would typically get a delivery, let's say, of bread on Tuesday and Friday, it may not show up on Tuesday and it might come on Wednesday instead, or it might not come that week at all. So the trucking and shipping is definitely an issue, and products that we order are not necessarily in stock. We're not able to get them. We might have ordered lettuce. In fact, I'm sure we have, but it's not coming in, whatever that might be. And it might be lettuce today, and it might be something else tomorrow. So we are absolutely seeing the impact of the supply chain broken.
And that's sad, because a lot of times this is the student's main meal that they're getting. So if there's any way that we can help, you know, as far as even for extra funds.
Well, so I will just tell you that students are still getting a reimbursable meal. So they might be getting different items than we anticipated putting in front of them, but they are still getting a reimbursable meal that is compliant with the federal regulations.
Okay.
And they are getting it at no cost. Those meals are free this year through the end of June, a breakfast and a lunch on a daily basis. Anything other than that would be at a cost. But a breakfast and a lunch for every child every day at no cost, and it meets the guidelines.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Just one quick note on that, Councilor Pellegrini, and to you, it's not anybody's fault. It's the truckers. There's no truckers out there. Mm-hmm. There is absolutely no truckers out there. I'm a Teamster. We have none. And those ships that are out in California, in the water, when they come in, they have nobody to deliver it. So you're doing a good job on that. I know we don't, there is no drivers. There's absolutely no drivers. So just to give you, it's not your fault.
For sure. I can tell you that somewhere in some of those ships, I have about 14 containers that were waiting to come in, and we don't even know where they are. But anyway, thank you for coming in this evening. I do have just a couple. Most of my questions were obviously asked and answered, but just a couple of hopefully easy ones. Touched on it early on when you said that we're still losing some students to private schools and enrollment is changing a bit. Is the percentage that we're losing to privates or that are choosing to go to private schools, is that percentage staying the same, going up, going down?
I think it's staying roughly the same. We took a look today at our withdrawals and the new enrollments, and they're pretty much flat. We had 6 additional enrollments, so it's very flat in terms of that change. I think the area that we're seeing a bit of an increase is in homeschool. The choice to homeschool, we saw a jump last year in homeschool, and it's kind of staying a little high. People are making the choice for a couple of different reasons. One might be fear of being in the school full and in person. The other might be some of the health and safety practices that we have in place. Just a couple examples of some of the choices that families are making. So we're seeing that still high, but the private or parochial schools is in the aggregate where we were about the same in terms of enrollments and withdrawals. And in the past several years, the numbers are going down.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, she forgot.
One of the things that you also touched on was the pie chart, for the specialists, and I know it's one of the questions that we as counselors get an awful lot of. Why are there more specialists, and isn't that taking away from the classroom? And I was happy to see your chart in there and your explanation, which I think can even be expanded upon, because I think that's a huge piece. There's 15 different types of specialists that are in the system for one reason or another, whether it's school psychologists, or English language learning, whatever they are. But explaining the need for them is something that we get, I know I do, get asked an awful lot. Why are they putting it there? Why aren't they putting it into the classroom? And I applaud the efforts of bringing that forward tonight and starting to explain that. I think it can be explained even in greater detail.
Can I jump on?
Please do.
So I think what I would say is to reframe it. It's not an either or. It's not taking away from the classroom. Who's supporting the classroom now is a team of people. A team of highly trained and expert individuals are supporting the classroom and supporting that classroom teacher in meeting a more diverse set of needs among students. And so so it's not taking away from the classroom. It's going directly there to support kids.
Yeah, and I totally understand it, because we hear it more often than somebody listening on TV, maybe that sees one meeting, and if they look at the budget, they see the budget and says, we're adding three specialists and we're adding two here. Well, why aren't we putting them in the classroom? That kind of stuff. So I think that this is very helpful. And I think it's something that should be on almost every presentation. Just my opinion. Two other very easy things, and I'm not sure who has the correct answer. The UVI, where are we with all of the schools now? The UVI technology. I saw him sitting in the back of the room.
Mike.
So the final phase install is just being completed this week, actually, at the Kennedy School. So all the buildings will have them installed, and right now our controls contractor is going around livening them up building by building. So over the next 3 weeks, we'll probably have everything fully livened up. We had finished the course last year, all the middle schools, right, library and the senior center, high schools first. So it's just these last,
wasn't sure where we
at police and now at Kennedy.
And the fire.
And fires, yeah. They did the fire stations. But so all the rest of the town buildings have been, the stuff has been installed in them, and we're just living them up. So, yep, everything will be live like 3 weeks.
Great. Thank you, Mike.
You're welcome.
And lastly, transportation. Everybody hears it, all of the news. You can't find bus drivers. Having been married to a bus driver that drove for 40 years, and they're trying to call her to come back. I don't think there's much chance of that happening, but...
pretty please. But,
the issue, this is a major issue. How is this affecting our transportation, and are we getting any support from the state? You know, you so, hear the National Guard.
So we don't have the National Guard.
Okay.
That's good.
We are transporting all of our students to and from home and school. Our biggest impacts are in our athletic runs and our after-school activities. Those are areas where our buses are having struggles being able to support. We're supporting our teams as well as we can. Our clubs and activities at this point, we're not running late buses, and that's very unfortunate because we are encouraging kids to participate in after school clubs and activities. This, we do believe that's really important for
students. Huge piece.
But that is one area where we are seeing the impact of a driver shortage.
Okay. Again, thank you very much for the presentation tonight. And I might just quickly add that having this presentation, not during a budget presentation, but having this type of presentation to us is hitting an audience that you don't usually see watching school committee meetings. There's a lot of people that just watch the council and just get bits and pieces of what's going on in the schools. And I, for one, would like to see moving forward, and I know these aren't easy to put together, but a couple of times a year, just coming in and giving us this kind of an update, because it is so informative to not only us, but to the people watching as well. Mm-hmm. So. I'll leave that tidbit out there. I know there's an awful lot on your plate, and I will take Councilor DeLocco made a comment a while ago about not wanting to sit in that school committee seat in the last year and a half. Having sat in it, that school committee seat in the 90s, I can tell you, I wouldn't want to say that. It had to be, it has to have been a very, very challenging time. And I applaud the efforts of the school committee and all the work that you've put in, and the administrative team, the teachers, right on down. It's just been a real challenging 2 years, but I believe our staff has stepped to the plate and done a magnificent job in handling it. So thank you, one and all.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to present.
Thank you.
We'll look forward to a return visit.
Next week.
We've got some homework.
Okay.
We are now producing this in collaboration with Franklin TV and Franklin Public Radio. This podcast is my public service effort for Franklin, but we can't do it alone. We can always use your help. How can you help? If you can use the information that you find here, please tell your friends and neighbors. If you don't like something here, please let me know. Through this feedback loop, we can continue to make improvements. And I thank you for listening. For additional information, please visit franklinmatters.org. If you have questions or comments, you can reach me directly at suresteve@gmail.com. The music for the intro and exit was provided by Michael Clark and the group East of Shirley. The piece is titled Ernesto Mañana, copyright Michael Clark and Tin Type Tunes in 2008, and used with their permission. I hope you enjoy. By the way, you can also subscribe and listen to Franklin Matters Radio on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. Search in podcasts for Franklin Matters.